Chapter 14. Contrasts in Kathmandu. After their return to Calcutta from Tibet, the sacred relics of the Arahants Shariputra and Moggallana, the two chief disciples of the Buddha, were to make only two more journeys outside India before their re-enshrinement in the new temple that was being built for them in Sanchi. The first of these journeys was to the Hindu kingdom of Nepal, and thus it was that for the second time that year I received a letter inviting me to accompany the sacred relics as part of the official delegation. This time the letter came from Devapriya Valisina, the General Secretary of the Mahabodhi Society, whom I had met in Gangtok when he put in a brief appearance there during the week that the sacred relics had spent in the village capital 6 months earlier. Venerable Sangharatana would not be going this time, Devapriyaji wrote, since with the pilgrim season fast approaching, his presence would be required at Sarnath. But Dr. Soft would be going, as well as several prominent members of the monastic order. And if he could spare the time, he hoped to go himself. Though the prospect of visiting Nepal did not affect me nearly so deeply as the prospect of visiting Tibet had done, and though Devapriyaji's letter certainly did not come like the answer to an unspoken wish, I was glad to accept the invitation and at once started making preparations for my departure. I had, of course, spent a few weeks in Nepal 2.5 years earlier, immediately after our ordination as shramaneras, or novice monks, in May 1949, my friend Buddharakshita and I had walked from Kushinara, the scene of the Buddha's final passing away, to Lumbini, the place of his birth, which was situated a few miles inside Nepalese territory. From Lumbini, we had walked up through the jungle to Baital, and from there had made our way across the first range of foothills to Palpa Tantan. In both places, we had stayed with the Nyuar Buddhists and had seen for ourselves the way in which Buddhism was persecuted under the orthodox Hindu despotism of the hereditary Rana prime ministers, who, for the last 100 years, had governed Nepal in the name of the king. But now everything was changed. In the course of the last 12 months, there had been armed uprisings against the Rana regime in several parts of the country. The king and other members of the royal family had taken refuge in the Indian embassy, from where they had been flown to New Delhi in an Indian Air Force plane. The Rana government had capitulated to a combination of insurrectionary tactics on the part of the Nepali Congress and diplomatic pressure on the part of the government of India. The king had returned in triumph to Kathmandu, and the last hereditary Rana prime minister had become the first prime minister of the new interim government. These developments, which my Nepalese friends in Kalimpong and Darjeeling followed with the keenest interest, had naturally affected the position of the Nyuar Buddhists and even, to some extent, the position of Buddhism itself. Under the autocratic rule of the Ranas, the Nyuar Buddhists had been subjected not only to the same political oppression as their Hindu neighbours, but to a certain amount of religious persecution as well. Buddhist activities in the wider sense were officially prohibited, as was the ordination of monks and the publication of books and magazines in the Nyuari language. In short, the free and open practice of the Buddha's teaching was virtually impossible. It was therefore not surprising that many of the more educated and influential members of the Nyuar Buddhist community should have been strongly opposed to the Rana regime, or that they should have supported the king in his efforts to regain the powers which, for the last 100 years, had been exercised on his behalf by the hereditary Rana prime ministers. The result was that when the king returned in triumph to Kathmandu in February 1951, the Buddhist Nyuars found themselves very much on the winning side and very much in the king's favour. Though the anti-Buddhist laws had not been repealed, they were no longer so strictly enforced, and the newer Buddhists were freer to practice and propagate their religion than they had been at any time within living memory. This meant that the headquarters of the reformist Dharmodaya Sabha, which had been founded 6 or 7 years earlier, could be transferred from Calcutta to Kathmandu. It meant that the handful of Ceylon and Burma-returned monks and their wealthy newer Buddhist supporters could make ambitious plans for the revival of Buddhism in Nepal along strictly Theravadin lines. Above all, it meant that with the consent of the king, who is reputed to be personally sympathetic to Buddhism, the sacred relics of the Arahants Shariputra and Moggallana could be invited to pay a 2-week visit to the land in which their great master had been born and brought up, and from which, at the age of 29, he had gone forth into the jungles of northeast India in search of supreme enlightenment. Since the Mahabodhi Society and the Dharmodaya Sabha were in regular contact with each other, and in fact had more than one leading member in common, the governing body of the society had readily accepted the invitation, which was extended in the name of the government and people of Nepal, though arrangements for the actual reception of the sacred relics were in the hands of the Dharmodaya Sabha. Moreover, since this would be the first real contact between the Buddhists of Nepal and the Buddhists of other Asian countries for many centuries, the governing body had decided that the delegation accompanying the sacred relics should, on this occasion, be as large and as representative as possible. Invitations were accordingly sent out, with the result that by early November they had assembled at the Mahabodhi Society's Calcutta headquarters some 15 or 20 monks and laymen from India, Ceylon, Greece and England, who, on the morning of the 6th of November, left Dum Dum Airport for Nepal, carrying with them the sacred relics of the two Arahants in their familiar silver gilt casket. It was the first time I had travelled in an aeroplane, and though my stomach reacted violently to the change of altitude, I felt strangely exhilarated. The weather was bright and clear, and the sunlight that streamed in through the windows on my right lit up the yellow and orange robes of the monks and sparkled on the hemispherical golden lid of the reliquary. Most of the other members of the delegation were already known to me, at least by name. Prominent among the lay delegates was the tall figure of Dr. Soft, who did not stay long in his seat beside Devapriya Valasinha, but moved up and down the aisle talking to the other passengers, including the Nepalese government officials who were accompanying us on the flight. Not far from Valasinha sat Venerable Jinaratana, a Sinhalese monk of about 40, who was one of the two joint secretaries of the Mahabodhi Society, the other being Venerable Sangharatana. I could see the back of his bald head gleaming above his seat and hear his harsh, cracked voice as he exchanged remarks in Sinhalese with a monk on the other side of the aisle. Though we had not yet really spoken to each other, that harsh, cracked voice was very familiar to me indeed. Some 5 years earlier, before taking up the life of a wandering ascetic, and while Valasinha was still in Ceylon, I had spent a month at the Sri Dharmarajika Vihara, as the Mahabodhi Society's Calcutta headquarters was called, and had been the witness of some rather un-monk-like behaviour on the part of His Holiness the High Priest, as Jinaratana had instructed me he was to be styled. And now that I was myself a monk, there was a feeling of awkwardness between us that neither of us had found a way of resolving. In other parts of the cabin sat Venerable Silabhadra, Venerable Dharmaratana, Badant Anand Kausalyayanan, and Venerable Narada Thera. I could see the backs of their bald heads gleaming above their seats, though none of them gleamed as brightly as Jinaratana's, which, like the tonsured head of Chaucer's monk, quote, shone as any glass, unquote. Seelabhadra was a Bengali ex-Hindu who had been ordained rather late in life after a career at the Rangoon Bar. Dhammaratana, a Sinhalese novice who was studying for a degree and who seemed to prefer smiling to speaking. Both of them stayed at the Sri Dhammarajika Vihara and helped Devapriya Valasina with the work of editing the Mahabodhi Journal. Anand Kausalyayan, or Anandji, as he was generally called, was the youngest member of the once famous trio of Anandji, Kashyapji, and Rahulji, a trio that had been broken up when Rahul Sankrityayan, its most distinguished member, gave up the robes after a series of episodes similar to that which had led to the downfall of great wisdom. A Punjabi by birth, he was a tall, rather striking figure, though his woolen cap and his carelessly draped upper robe made him look more like a Hindu sadhu than a Buddhist monk. As I had known since the time when Aniruddha was trying to throw me out of the Dharmodaya Vihara, and I was wondering to whom I could turn for help, he was the vice president of the Dharmodaya Sabha, and had, moreover, the reputation of being very anti-British. To what extent this reputation was justified, I had no means of telling, but on meeting him and the other delegates at the Sri Dhammarajika Vihara a few days before our departure, I had been relieved to find no trace of any anti-British bias in his attitude towards me. On the contrary, he took a friendly but detached interest in the young English monk who had been invited to accompany the sacred relics to Nepal, and showed no awareness whatever of the unhappy events that had taken place at the Dharmodaya Vihara a year earlier. Anandji's interest in me was shared by Venerable Narada Thera, who sat near the sacred relics in the forward half of the cabin, somewhat apart from the other monks. We had already talked more than once since my arrival at the Sri Dhammarajika Vihara. Indeed, had I been wearing a Western-style suit instead of the traditional monastic robes, the middle-aged Sinhalese monk with the curiously high-pitched voice and the rather simian features could be said to have buttonholed me. Besides being the senior-most monk on board the aeroplane, Narada Thera was, as I well knew, the doyen of the English-speaking monks of Ceylon, in great demand as a lecturer both inside and outside his own country. He was the author of innumerable simply written pamphlets on Theravada Buddhism, or, as he preferred to call it, the Pure Dhamma. Tens of thousands of these pamphlets had been printed for free distribution by his lay admirers. But though I had come across a good many of them in the course of my travels, they had not added much to my understanding of Theravada Buddhism. Whatever his limitations as an exponent of Buddhism, however, Narada Thera undoubtedly had a genius for buttonholing people. We had not been in the air for many minutes before he succeeded in buttonholing Prince Peter of Greece, who had gone to take a closer look at the sacred relics, or rather, at the silver gilt reliquary in which they were contained. Both before and after the meeting at which Lee Gotami had shown her tracings of the Tsaparan frescoes, and at which she and Princess Irene had very nearly been involved in a tug-of-war over one of them, Prince Peter had occasionally dropped in at the Hermitage for a cup of tea and a chat. On such occasions, he invariably came riding on a chestnut-coloured horse, which he tethered to a tree near the gate, and wearing a sort of cowboy costume, complete with red check shirt, neckerchief, and Stetson. In this way, we had gradually become more closely acquainted, though without ever really becoming friends. And he had told me about such things as his visit to South India, where he had studied polyandry among the Todas, and where Princess Irene had added to her already extensive collection of love charms. I was, therefore, hardly surprised when, having heard that I was going to Nepal with the sacred relics, He sent me a note inquiring if I thought there was any chance of his going too. He was very interested in the country and would like to see it before, as now seemed likely, it was modernized out of all resemblance to its former traditional self. On receiving this note, I immediately wrote to Deva Priyaji, who in turn wrote to Prince Peter, inviting him to accompany these sacred relics as a member of the official delegation. Thus it was that among the 15 or 20 monks and laymen who had assembled at the Mahabodhi Society's Calcutta headquarters, there had been someone from Greece and Denmark, and thus it was that Prince Peter was with us on the aeroplane and being buttonholed by Narada Thera. But I soon ceased paying much attention to my fellow delegates. After we had been in the air for about half an hour, and my stomach had adjusted to the change of altitude, I started looking out of the window. As I peered through the thick glass, I saw a panorama such as, before the 20th century, had been visible to none but gods and those favoured mortals whom the gods had caught up bodily into the air. Far below me was a green patchwork of fields, with here and there a tiny village or grove of trees. I was reminded of the time when, 2 years earlier, I had climbed to the top of the Vulture's Peak near Rajgir in Bihar and had seen 1,000 feet below me a similar green patchwork. On the present occasion, I was looking down from a height many times greater than that of the Vulture's Peak, and without having any connection with the earth, and the green patchwork below me consisted not of hundreds, but of thousands of fields. Some of the fields were light green in colour, others dark green, while through them there wound ochre-coloured rivers, which, though many times wider than even the biggest field, from the height from which I was surveying them, looked no more than streams. An hour and a half later, when all the monks on board had been fed and the laymen had started on their own meal, the green patchwork of the Gangetic plain gave way to the continuous dark green of the Nepalese Terai. At the same time, huge masses of cumulus cloud came floating past, every now and then engulfing us in a rush of spectral vapours that blotted out the blue sky and the sunshine. We also got into an air pocket and for several appalling minutes were tossed about in a manner that threatened to tear apart the quivering and groaning walls of the cabin and expose us all to the fury of the elements. When the aeroplane finally righted itself, however, I saw on the distant horizon, dazzlingly white against the intense blue of the sky, the long line of the Himalayas. For so many hundreds of miles did they seem to extend that I fancied I could see, far away to the east, the familiar double peak of Mount Kanchenjunga. In a matter of minutes, we were over the first range of foothills and making a rapid descent into the Kathmandu Valley. According to tradition, the valley had originally been a lake, but Manjushri, the Bodhisattva of Wisdom, had cleft the hills to the south with his sword, thus draining away the waters and turning the whole area into a green and fruitful garden. As the aeroplane banked and circled, we could see Kathmandu spread out below us with the white dome and golden spire of Swayambhunath just visible to the west of the town. A few minutes later came the sudden jolt of touchdown. We had arrived. For the second time in my life, I was visiting the land of the Buddha's birth, and I was visiting it, moreover, under circumstances very different from those of 2.5 years ago. Then I had entered the country on foot with a single companion and without official permission, whereas now I was entering it by the most modern form of transport, with the sacred relics and the other members of the delegation, and as the guest of the government and people of Nepal. On emerging from the aeroplane into the crisp, sunlit air of the valley, so different from the smoke-laden atmosphere of Calcutta, we found a great crowd of people waiting at the aerodrome. Most of them were Newars, and most of them were clad, men and women alike, in pure white garments, the whiteness of which contrasted in the most striking manner with the drab khaki of the Gurkha policemen, who were engaged in holding them back and preventing them from surging forward onto the tarmac and surrounding the aeroplane. Though I did not know it at the time, this contrast of white and khaki, Newar and Gurkha, was the first of the many contrasts that I was to encounter in the course of the next 2 weeks. When the delegates had formed themselves into a sort of procession, with the monks in the van and the lay members bringing up the rear, the sacred relics were taken from the aeroplane to a marquee that had been pitched nearby. Here they were received by King Tribhuvan, a plump, pleasant-looking man of about 40, whom I had seen some 5 years previously in Calcutta, strolling in Eden Gardens with 10 or 12 members of his entourage. On that occasion he had been wearing, like them, a dark Western-style suit, but now he wore traditional Nepalese costume, consisting of double-breasted shirt, jodhpurs and conical cap, though with the addition of a Western-style jacket. From the marquee, the sacred relics were taken in procession to the Narayan Hiti, or Abode of Narayan, as the royal palace was called. It was so called because the king was popularly regarded as the incarnation of the god Vishnu, the second member of the Hindu trinity of Brahma the creator, Vishnu the preserver, and Maheshvara, or Shiva, the destroyer. Indeed, the 10 monarchs of the Shah dynasty, from Prithvi Narayan to King Tribhuvan, were collectively known as the Das Avatar, or 10 incarnations, and prints depicting all 10 of them together were often seen in the homes of pious and patriotic Nepalis. This Nepalese set of 10 incarnations was, of course, quite different from the standard Hindu set, but this fact had not prevented the Rana prime ministers, otherwise rigidly orthodox, from encouraging the cult of the Nepalese Das Avatar. If the king was the incarnation of Vishnu, he was far too sacred a person to be concerned with the government of the country, which was best left in the hands of ordinary mortals. He was far too sacred to be exposed to the gaze of his subjects, and except for the occasional brief visit to Benares or Calcutta, should remain secluded in the Narayan Hiti. But now all that was changed. Since the upheavals of 9 months ago, the king had become actively involved in the process of transition from autocracy to democracy, and was showing himself in public more and more frequently. This was why he could receive the sacred relics on their arrival at the aerodrome and ride in procession with them to the Narayan Hiti. This was why he could see for himself the enthusiasm with which they were welcomed by his subjects. The enthusiasm indeed was immense. Thousands of people lined the streets through which the procession passed, all eager to pay their respects to the memory of the two Arahants. As at the aerodrome, most of them were Newars, and, as at the aerodrome, most of them were clad in spotless white garments, the whiteness of which again contrasted strikingly with the drab khaki of the Gurkha policemen who were holding them back and preventing them from getting in the way of the procession. Such was people's enthusiasm that it took us some time to reach the wrought iron gates of the Narayan Hiti. Here I was disappointed to find not a grander version of the pagoda-type buildings I had glimpsed on our way through the town, but a neoclassical structure which, with its pillared facade and lateral flights of steps, was more like a provincial town hall or a city bank than the abode of the incarnation of Vishnu. Between the ancient and the modern architecture of Kathmandu, as between the king and his official residence, there in fact was a contrast no less striking than that between the white of the Newar worshippers and the khaki of the Gurkha policeman. Since the sacred relics were to be kept for the time being at the royal palace, the members of the delegation were taken from the Narayan Hiti straight to the quarters which they would be occupying for the duration of their stay. The monks were taken to the Ananda Kuti Vihara, a small monastery on the slopes of the Swayambhunath Hill that had been constructed only a few years previously, and which, as the headquarters of the Dharmodia Sabha, was the centre of reformist Theravada Buddhism in Nepal. On our arrival there, however, it soon became obvious that the place was not big enough to accommodate all of us. Arrangements were therefore made for Anand Kosalyayan and me to stay a short distance round the hill at a place called Shantiniketan, though we would eat at the Vihara with the other monks, except, of course, when we were all invited to the house of a lay supporter for a ceremonial food offering. As it turned out, this suited me admirably. Shantiniketan, or the Abode of Peace, was neither a monastery nor a layman's house, but the abode of a Vajrayana, or Tantric Buddhist, guru, who, as I afterwards learned, had a considerable following in the Kathmandu Valley among both Buddhists and Hindus. As he was ill in bed when we arrived, Anandji and I did not see him, but we were warmly welcomed by his four sons, all of whom were clad in white, and whose ages ranged from 16 to 22 or 23. At first they were a little shy, but there's no mistaking the interest and goodwill with which they regarded the two foreign Buddhists. I was probably the first Westerner they had ever seen, and did not take us long to win their confidence. By the time Anandji and I retired for the night, in fact, a definite feeling of warmth had sprung up between the four young hermits and ourselves, and I looked forward to getting to know them better. It was indeed fortunate that for the next 2 weeks I would be staying not amidst the noise and bustle of Ananda Kuti, but in the peaceful atmosphere of Shantiniketan. The next morning I was awoken before dawn by the sound of distant singing. The sound was of indescribable sweetness and seemed to be the product not of a single voice, but of scores, even hundreds of voices. It also seemed to move in waves up the hillside, so that no sooner had one wave reached the top than another started from the bottom, or even from halfway up. As I afterwards discovered, the singing, which I heard every morning of my stay, proceeded from the bands of worshippers who, while it was still dark, made their way up the flights of stone steps leading to the spacious platform, where, from amidst 100 lesser shrines, the great white dome and gilded spire of the Swayambhunath stupa towered aloft into the heavens. As the worshippers made their way up the steps, and as they circumambulated the stupa, they sang a variety of traditional devotional songs, all of them of such extraordinary sweetness that, on hearing them for the first time, one might well think that choirs of invisible angels were hovering round the sacred hill, singing the praises of the Buddha, Dharma and Sangha. It was an ideal way to be woken up, and the effect of the singing lasted until long after I had risen, and long after Anandji and I had left for Ananda Kuti. It lasted until, at about 10 o'clock, we went with the other monks to the house of Bajiratna, the father of Gayan and Manihar's Jyoti, for our first ceremonial food offering in Nepal. Here there was bad news awaiting us. The procession and public meeting that had been planned for the afternoon would probably have to be cancelled. What had happened was that the previous evening, the evening of the very day of the arrival of the sacred relics in Nepal, there had been a student demonstration against the interim government's recent security order, and 10 of the demonstrators had been arrested. When their comrades had attempted to storm the police station to which they had been taken, the police tried to disperse them with tear gas, and when this proved ineffectual, opened fire with their rifles. As a result, one student had been killed and two injured. Once again, I was confronted by a contrast, this time between violence, as represented by the demonstrators and the police, and non-violence, as represented by these sacred relics. It seemed a pity that the forces of democracy and the forces of autocracy could not agree on a truce, at least for the 2 weeks that the relics of the Buddha's two chief disciples would be spending in the land of their great master's birth. Unfortunately, it appears more likely that both parties would try to manipulate the visit in their own interests. While we were discussing the situation, the leader of the students, a youngish Nyuwa Buddhist named Dhammaratna, came to see us. Since the students would be taking out a procession of their own that afternoon, he told us, it would not be possible for them to join the procession that would be taking the sacred relics to the parade ground for the public meeting. And if we insisted on holding the procession as planned, there might be a clash. Whether he was simply pointing out possible consequences or threatening us with them, it was difficult to tell. Perhaps he himself did not know. Be that as it may, we replied that whether or not the sacred relics were taken in procession that day depended entirely on His Majesty's wishes. As soon as we had finished our meal, therefore, and had chanted the usual verses of blessing, we went in a body to the Narayan Hiti and told the king what Dhammaratna had said. It did not take him long to decide that the wisest course would be to postpone both the procession and the public meeting until the following afternoon, by which time the passions aroused by the shooting would have cooled down. During the half hour or so that we were with King Tribhuvan, I was able to observe him much more closely than had been possible in the comparatively crowded marquee where he had received the sacred relics the previous day. The dark curls that peeped out from beneath his conical Nepalese cap and framed his rather puffy face gave him a distinctly youthful appearance, particularly as the cap was made of soft, gaily patterned material and was worn at a slightly rakish angle. Despite his rather anxious expression, it was clear that he was a good-natured, well-meaning man who genuinely wanted to do what was best for his country. At the same time, I gained the impression that he was possessed of no great strength of character and could easily be influenced by other people. It was noticeable that in the course of our discussion with him, he kept turning for advice to his private secretary, a smooth-faced, smiling young Nyuwa Buddhist who wore the same traditional Nepalese costume as the king, except that his cap was made of an even more gaily patterned material and was worn at an even more rakish angle. Since there would be no procession that day and no public meeting, the members of the delegation accompanying the sacred relics had more time at their disposal than they had expected. On our leaving the Narayan Hiti, a small party of us consisting of Anand Kausalyayan, Sila Bhadra, Dhammaratna, Jinaratna, and myself, therefore decided to pay a visit to the temple of Pashupatinath, the biggest and most important Hindu shrine in Kathmandu, to which pilgrims came from all over Nepal, and indeed from many parts of India. On our way to the temple, we called in at the rest house in which the lay delegates were staying, where we knew we would find Dhammaloka and Mahanama, the two monks who we hoped would be able to accompany us to Pashupatinath, and in Mahanama's case, act as our interpreters. Dhammaloka was a young Sinhalese monk with protruding ears and a toothy smile, while his friend Mahanama, with whom I had corresponded the previous year in his capacity as secretary of the Dharmodia Sabha, was the rather effete nephew of Baju Ratna and cousin of the Jyoti brothers. Unlike the other Niwa monks, he wore his hair quite long for a bhikshu and sported a silk robe that he threw back over one shoulder in a decidedly elegant fashion. The temple that we had decided to visit was situated on the outskirts of Kathmandu, on the banks of the Bagmati River, and consisted of a cluster of buildings dominated by a pagoda with a golden roof. Though the place as a whole was of no great architectural interest, there was much for us to see and admire as Dhammaloka and Mahanama led our little party through the maze of halls, courtyards and corridors that occupied the area between the main entrance and the Sanctum Sanctorum. On the way, we were particularly impressed by the magnificence of the ornamentation, which, usually in the form of wood carving and beaten metalwork in copper, silver and brass, confronted us at every turn. We were rather less impressed by the dirty and neglected condition of the place, parts of which were so badly in need of repair as to be in danger of tumbling down, and impressed least of all by the 7 or 8 Brahmin pujaris, or officiating priests, who glared at us from the depths of the Sanctum Sanctorum as we approached. They were, in fact, the most villainous-looking crew I had ever seen, and with their unkempt hair, bloodshot eyes, and general attitude of suspiciousness, resembled a gang of dacoits rather than a band of pujaris. What was even more surprising, they were not Nepalese, but South Indians of some kind. Their complexions were, indeed, so dark as to be almost black, and their blackness was heightened by the bright red of the robes they wore. Presumably they were red, so as not to show the blood with which they were splashed during the animal sacrifices. At first they were extremely unwilling that we should set foot in the Sanctum Sanctorum, but after Mahanama had expostulated with them for a few minutes, apparently pointing out that we were state guests and had come straight from the Narayan Hiti, they not so much allowed us to enter as refrained from preventing us, when, seeing that they had begun to waver, Dinaratna strode boldly in and the rest of us followed. It was not that they objected to the presence of Buddhists. In Nepal it was quite usual for Buddhists and Hindus to frequent each other's places of worship. What they objected to was the presence of people who, like the English and the Ceylonese, had come to India and Nepal from beyond the Kala Pani, or Black Water, and who, as Mlekes, or barbarians, were automatically in a state of ritual pollution. In the case of Indians and Nepalese who had travelled abroad, such pollution could always be removed by the performance of the appropriate ceremonies. But where we were concerned, the pujaris had no means of telling whether or not those ceremonies had been performed, or, in the case of at least some of us, whether it is even possible for them to be performed. They had, consequently, no means of telling whether or not our presence polluted the Sanctum Sanctorum. As we wandered round the place, they therefore muttered to themselves and scowled. Apart from the ornamentation, there was not much to see. The principal object of interest was the image, 2 or 3 feet in height, that stood in the centre of the chamber. Since it was smothered in garlands of red and yellow flowers, and since the pujaris had grouped themselves round it as though to protect it from profanation, I was not able to see it very clearly. But it appeared to have 4 faces, one fronting each of the chamber's 4 entrances. It was, in fact, not a fully anthropomorphic image at all, but a representation of the god Maheshvara, or Shiva, the 3rd member of the Hindu Trinity, in the form of a 4-faced linga, or phallus. Pashupati, or the Lord of Beasts, to whom the temple was dedicated, being one of the many different aspects of Shiva. having seen what there was to see in the Sanctum Sanctorum. We were not sorry to leave the villainous-looking pujaris and make our way to the steps that led down to the Bagmati, which was considered to be the Ganges of Nepal, just as Pashupati, the district in which Pashupatinath was situated, was considered to be its Benares. These steps extended for quite a distance, and Mahanama described how it was the custom of pious Hindus to be brought here to die. They were set down at the bottom of the steps in such a manner that their feet were covered by the water of the sacred river. To die in this way was regarded as highly auspicious. A Hindu who died in this way would be sure to go to heaven. It was also considered necessary for the welfare of the state that the king should expire in the same orthodox fashion, even though in his case it was not a question of going to heaven as a result of merit, so much as of returning by virtue of his inherent divinity to the supernal abode from which he had descended for the benefit of the people of Nepal. As Mahanama spoke, I saw in my mind's eye a picture of King Tribhuvan being carried down to the water's edge to die, and lying there, perhaps day after day and night after night, until his eyes finally closed forever. But this was not to be. Less than 4 years later, King Tribhuvan died, not on the banks of the Bagmati, but more prosaically, in a hospital in Zurich. This picture of King Tribhuvan lying at the bottom of the steps with his feet immersed in the water is associated with an actual image I saw that afternoon in or near the precincts of the Pashupatinath temple. The image was of the god Vishnu. The second member of the Hindu Trinity was not standing upright, but lying flat on his back, and he was lying in a kind of tank, the waters of which scarcely covered his finely moulded torso. They certainly did not cover his diademed head, or his well-braceleted arms, or the great cobra's hood that arched protectively above him, a hood that belonged to the serpent on whose invisible coils he lay stretched out as though on a bed. The god's eyes were closed, but not in ordinary slumber. They were closed in the aeon-long sleep that succeeds the destruction of the universe and precedes its recreation. And on his face there was an expression of passionless calm. 24 hours later, the expression on almost every human face was one of joy. As the king had foreseen, the passions aroused by the police shooting had cooled down, and it was possible to go ahead with the procession and public meeting, albeit one day later than originally planned. Nevertheless, the fact that only 2 days earlier a student had been killed could not but make a difference, and the procession was not quite so successful as the organisers had hoped. The public meeting, however, was a complete success. Thousands of people were present and listened with varying degrees of attention to speeches in Nepali, Niwari, and English. On the platform with the sacred relics and the accompanying delegation sat the king and the crown prince, the prime minister, and other members of the interim government, and sundry notabilities. Among these was a mild-looking man in Gandhian dress, who, I was told, had been freed at the time of the Democratic Revolution, after spending 18 years in jail for opposing the Rana regime. To me, the most interesting figure on the platform, however, was that of the Prime Minister, Mohan Shemsa Janga Bahadur Rana, a dignified old man in a Mughal-style sherwani, or long coat, and a black pillbox hat. Paying no attention to the proceedings, he sat with his hands clasping the top of his stick and head sunk on his chest. As Prince Peter remarked to me afterwards, he looked like a beaten old lion. While opinions may have differed as to whether he looked like a lion, there was no doubt that the last of the hereditary Rana Prime Minister of Nepal was beaten. The forces of democracy had triumphed over the forces of autocracy. Indeed, only 3 days later, Mohan Shemsa was forced to resign as Prime Minister of the interim government, his place being taken by MP Koirala, the titular head of the Nepali Congress, and one of the two famous Koirala brothers. Both brothers were on the platform that afternoon, and inevitably one of them was called upon to speak. As the preternaturally thin figure in light blue Nepali dress strode purposely to the microphone, one might have been forgiven for thinking that if Mohan Shemsa looked like a beaten old lion, at least one of the Koirala brothers looked remarkably like a triumphant young jackal. The contrast between the representative of autocracy and the representative of democracy was in fact as striking as any I had yet encountered in Kathmandu. It was not simply that whereas Mohan Shemsa had completed his 70 years, the Koirala brother was only halfway through his, or that whereas one was clad in black and grey, the other was dressed from top to toe in light blue. The real contrast was between the respective attitudes of the two men. Mohan Shemsa was not only defeated, but exhausted and demoralised by his defeat, as well as profoundly pessimistic about the future of the country. The Koirala brother, on the other hand, was not only victorious, but stimulated and elated by victory, as well as highly optimistic about the future of the country. Watching the blue-clad figure at the microphone as he harangued the crowd, and seeing the way in which his meagre frame was dilated with pride, arrogance and ambition, I could not help wondering whether Nepal would, in fact, be better off under democracy than under autocracy. Were Messrs. MP and BP Koirala really an improvement on Mohan Shemsa? Would they use their newly acquired power for the benefit of the people whose interests they claimed to represent, or would they use it for their own aggrandizement? Time alone would tell. Meanwhile, as I looked from the beaten old lion to the triumphant young jackal, I had to acknowledge that, as far as present appearances went, my sympathies were with the former rather than with the latter. This was partly owing to the fact that, almost regardless of the goodness or badness of his cause, a man not unoften is a nobler figure in defeat than in victory. Indeed, it might even be argued that whereas victory frequently brings out the worst in people, defeat no less frequently brings out the best. Not that defeat had brought out the best in Mohan Shemsa. As the old Prime Minister sat there with hands clasping the top of his stick and head sunk on his chest, he was not even a noble figure, but at least he was a dignified one, and to that extent deserving of respect. When the time came for me to speak, therefore, I addressed myself not only to the monks, the king, the crown prince, and the other members of the audience, but also to the Prime Minister, whose presence on the platform the previous speakers had ignored. "Venerable Sirs, Your Majesty, Your Royal Highnesses, Your Highness," I began in my most formal manner, turning to each of them as I spoke. As I turned to the Prime Minister, who was officially styled His Highness the Maharaja, the King was known as the Maharaja de Raja, the old man acknowledged the courtesy with a stately inclination of his head. In my speech, I emphasised the fact that the Buddha had been born and brought up in Nepal, and that Nepal was a country with a long and glorious tradition of Buddhist civilization and culture. In particular, I emphasised the importance of its art and architecture, and said how impressed I was by what I had already seen of these. I also exhorted Buddhists and Hindus alike to remember that the best way of honouring the memory of the Buddha and his two great Arahant disciples was by actually practising his teaching. In all this, there was nothing that the other Buddhist speakers, especially those belonging to the delegation accompanying the sacred relics, might not have said, and in fact did say. Towards the end of my speech, however, I struck a more original note. It was a note of warning. "In places like Darjeeling and Kalimpong," I said, "there were people who had their eye on Nepal and who followed developments there with very great interest. These people were the Christian missionaries, and the reason they followed developments in Nepal with so much interest was that they wanted to enter the country and proselytize it. Both Hindus and Buddhists should be aware of them. On no account should they be allowed to set foot on the soil of Nepal. Besides being cunning and unscrupulous, they were extremely determined, and once they had succeeded in establishing themselves anywhere, it was very difficult to get rid of them, and very difficult to stop them undermining the indigenous religion and culture. In striking this note of warning, I was motivated by an intense desire that Nepal should be spared the havoc that Christian missionaries had wrought in other Asian countries. Though conditions in Nepal were far from perfect, and though there were plenty of things that needed changing or abolishing, for instance the caste system and animal sacrifice, Nepal was one of the few traditional societies still left in the world, and it would be a thousand pities if it should be overrun by Bible-thumping fanatics who knew no better way of propagating the gospel than by abusing other religions and inducing potential converts to change their faith by offering them such things as modern education, medical treatment, employment, and even hard cash. That Nepal had not been overrun by such fanatics years ago was entirely due to the fact that under the Rana regime, Christian missionaries had not been permitted to enter the country. When I struck my note of warning, therefore, I referred to what I did not hesitate to call the wisdom of the previous regime in keeping the missionaries out, and urged the government and people of Nepal not to depart from that policy. The fact that I could refer to the Rana regime in these complimentary terms, and that I was willing to give even the devil his due, did not go unnoticed, either on or off the platform. Out of the corner of my eye, I saw Mohan Shemsa, who had looked up when I started speaking, was regarding me with an expression of mild surprise on his thin, careworn face. He had certainly not expected to hear any words of praise for the detested Rana regime that afternoon, least of all from a Buddhist monk. But though I had spoken out loud and clear on the subject of Christian missionaries, I was far from being satisfied that I had done enough. A warning that is given in public must be followed up in private, and in this case, what better person was there with whom I could follow it up than with King Tribhuvan, who, besides being the connecting link between the old regime and the new, autocracy and democracy, was the embodiment of the collective identity of his people and the guardian of the traditional values on which their lives were based. That same evening, therefore, I went to the Narayan Hiti with three other members of the delegation accompanying the sacred relics, all of whom were in strong agreement with what I had said in my speech, and wanting to express to the king their own concern lest Christian missionaries should be allowed to enter Nepal. These were Narada Thera, Devapriya Valensina, and the well-known writer Sri Nisanka. As Sinhalese Buddhists, all three of them knew far better than I did the kind of damage that Christian missionaries were capable of inflicting on an Asian country. Had not the Portuguese, Dutch, and British emissaries of the Church and the Gospel descended on Ceylon in three successive waves, and had not each of them in turn striven to eradicate the indigenous religion and culture? As Sinhalese Buddhists, my three companions could, therefore, give expression to their concern, not just with a full knowledge of the facts, but with considerable warmth of feeling. In these circumstances, it was not surprising that the king heard us with close attention and appeared to take our private warnings as seriously as the one I had already given in public. At all events, Lok Darshan, as the smooth-faced, smiling young private secretary was called, was told to make a note of the matter, and we were left with the impression that something would actually be done. This was all the more reassuring, inasmuch as we had heard rumours to the effect that, Taking advantage of the politically unsettled condition of the country, Roman Catholic missionaries had already infiltrated some of the more outlying districts from their bases in India and were at work among the unsuspecting tribal people. It was on account of these rumours, in fact, that I had decided to strike my note of warning that afternoon and draw attention to the danger before it was too late. Besides expressing our concern about missionaries to the king, we raised the question of government support for a Buddhist school. The two subjects were, of course, closely connected, since missionaries were often able to gain a foothold by means of their educational work. Only that morning, Narada Thera and I had been to see the proposed site of a school that the Dharmodaya Sabha was planning to build. On our way back, however, we found that a Buddhist school had already been established in the neighbourhood of Swayambhunath by a Vajracharya, who, we were informed, had actually manufactured the bricks for the building with his own hands. This unexpected discovery both surprised and delighted us, and on our return to the Anandakuti Vihara, Narada Thera suggested to the leading members of the Dharmodaya Sabha that instead of trying to build a school of their own, they should join forces with the enterprising Vajracharya and help to develop his school. Since the Dharmodaya Sabha was supported by only a minority of newer Buddhists, mainly by Bhajiratna and his sons, the suggestion was a sensible one, but it was soon evident that Mahanama, Manihas Jyoti and the rest did not find it acceptable. The followers of reformist Theravada Buddhism had no intention of cooperating with a follower of the Vajrayana. Naturally, Narada Thera and I said nothing to King Tribhuvan about these divisions among his newer Buddhist subjects. We were concerned simply to obtain from him a promise of government support for a Buddhist school, and this we had no difficulty in doing. I also took advantage of the opportunity to ask the king if there would be any objection to my returning to Nepal. Since the day of my arrival, I had been talking to people about the possibility of forming a YMBA in Kathmandu, but mindful of what had happened in Darjeeling and Gangtok, I did not want to take any definite steps in that direction without being sure I would be able to spend some time there whenever necessary. Fortunately, the king said there would be no objection to my coming again, and the four of us left the Narayan Hiti well satisfied with our evening's work. From the following morning, the sacred relics were exposed for the veneration of the public. The first exposition took place at the Anandakuti Vihara, to which the sacred relics had been taken after the public meeting, and where they were to be kept for the following week. Eager to show their respect for the memory of the Buddha's chief disciples, as well as to obtain whatever blessings they could from the relics themselves, hundreds of white-clad Nuas had been pouring into the Vihara since dawn and were waiting in a jostling, excited mass for the inauguration of the worship of the sacred relics to begin. Once again, I realized how lucky I was to be staying in the peaceful atmosphere of Shantiniketan. That morning, the worship was inaugurated by Prime Minister Mohan Shemsa, and as was customary, he inaugurated it by unlocking the silver gilt reliquary so that the lid could be removed and the capsules containing the relics exposed to view. When Venerable Amritananda handed him the key, however, the old man looked doubtfully at the reliquary and asked, "Do I have to touch it?" "Of course," replied Venerable Amritananda cheerfully, whereupon, very slowly and gingerly, Mohan Shemsa inserted the key in the lock and gave it a single cautious turn. The reason for the Prime Minister's reluctance was that, what to the pious Buddhists were sacred relics, to the orthodox Hindu were simply pieces of human bone, and as such parts of a dead body, any contact with which automatically involved ritual pollution. When, later on in the morning, Venerable Amritananda told me what had happened, at the time I was too far away to hear the exchange between him and the Prime Minister, I expressed considerable surprise that, even though he might want to oblige the newer Buddhists for political reasons, an orthodox old Hindu like Mohan Shamsa should allow himself to incur ritual pollution by touching the casket containing these sacred relics. Amritananda's almond eyes narrowed with amusement at my simplicity. Hindu orthodoxy was a very elastic thing, he explained, especially where the Ranas of Nepal were concerned. All Mohan Shamsa had to do was to take a ritual bath when he got home and get his household Brahmins to mutter a few Vedic mantras over him. At the worst, he would have to swallow the 5 sacred products of the cow: milk, clarified butter, curds, urine, and cow dung. Personally, he found it difficult to understand how it could be more polluting to touch the casket containing the sacred relics than to swallow some of those things. From the way in which Amritananda said it, it was clear that he did not have much sympathy for the predicament in which the Prime Minister had found himself that morning. I even got the impression that, as a newer Buddhist, he derived a certain amount of satisfaction from the thought that the former upholder of the anti-Buddhist laws had been obliged to show respect for the sacred relics, even at the expense of his Hindu orthodoxy. Indeed, I got the impression that he derived a certain amount of satisfaction from the thought that by handing Mohan Shamsa the key of the reliquary and answering his question in the way he did, he had been personally responsible for scoring that particular tactical moral victory. Whether or not this was the case, there was no doubt that with the newer Buddhists now on the winning side and in favour with the king, Venerable Amritananda's star was in the ascendant. There was also no doubt that he was well aware of this and was taking full advantage of the fact. Though the conversation that followed Amritananda's tactical moral victory over Mohan Shamsa was the first that we had been able to have since my arrival, I had known him since the beginning of 1950. We had met at Rajgir when he accompanied Kashyapji and myself on our expedition to the Pipala Cave. Since then he had been staying in Kathmandu, apart from a few months in Kalimpong, of course. But despite the fact that he was permitted to preach only at the Anandakuti Vihara, he had already become highly popular as a preacher among the newer Buddhists. With the advent of the democratic revolution and the collapse of the Rana autocracy, he had naturally been able to expand the scope of his activities considerably and do a number of things he had not been able to do before. Though by no means the senior most of the Ceylon and Burma-returned newer monks, of whom there were about 24 in Nepal, he was by far the most energetic and capable, and when a committee was set up to make arrangements for the reception of these sacred relics, he was inevitably appointed secretary. Since King Tribhuvan was chairman of the committee, Amritananda frequently had occasion to meet him and was in and out of the Narayan Hiti at all hours. Indeed, he had become quite a favourite with the king, and on one occasion, it may have been on the king's birthday, had even been permitted to chant Buddhist verses of blessing over him in Pali and tie a thread of protection round his wrist, a thing that would have been unthinkable under the previous regime. But success is rarely without its drawbacks. The fact that Amritananda had risen to a position of some influence, even though not of real power, had not unnaturally created a certain distance between him and the other newer monks, with the result that, distance having led to mistrust and mistrust to misunderstanding, he was criticised on account of a number of things that might otherwise have passed without comment. He was particularly criticised for chanting verses of blessing over the king and tying the thread of protection round his wrist while he himself was standing and the king seated on his throne. By performing the ceremony in this way, it was felt, he had lowered the dignity of the monastic order, members of which should neither remain standing when a layman is seated, nor occupy a seat lower than that of a layman, even when the layman happened to be the incarnation of Vishnu. There had also been differences between Amritananda on the one hand and the Jyoti brothers and Mahanama on the other, though what these differences were about, it was impossible for a non-Nuwa to tell. Nevertheless, they were sufficiently serious for Amritananda and Manihas Jyoti to have become leaders of what were virtually two factions among the members and supporters of the Dharmodaya Sabha. With the arrival of the sacred relics, however, a change had taken place. Mistrust and misunderstanding had been dissipated, criticism forgotten, and differences set aside, at least for the time being. All sections of the Nuwa community had been swept by a great wave of joy, a joy that had come surging up from the depths of their hearts. Whether rich or poor, men or women, high caste or low caste, for the Hindu caste system had been imposed on them centuries ago, they all rejoiced that they were able to pay homage to the memory of the two arahants who had been the Buddha's two chief disciples. They rejoiced that they were able to welcome Buddhists from other countries. They rejoiced that the sacred relics had been kept at the Narayanhiti. They rejoiced that there had been a procession and a public meeting. They rejoiced that they were freer to practice and propagate their religion than they'd ever been before. They rejoiced that public recognition had been given to the importance of Buddhism, and therefore to the importance of the Nuwa Buddhists. They rejoiced that the sacred relics were being exposed for worship at the Ananda Kuti Vihara, and that they were being looked after by relays of yellow-robed monks of their own community, who were able to tell them about the lives of Shariputra and Moggallana in their own language. As for the Nuwa monks themselves, they rejoiced that they were free to preach the Dharma and that they could look after the sacred relics and minister to the needs of the hundreds of worshippers who poured into the Vihara each day. So much, in fact, did Amritananda and the rest of the Nuwa monks rejoice in looking after the sacred relics that they were glad to take on the entire responsibility for so doing. This left the visiting monks much freer than Sangharatana and I had been in Gangtok, Kalimpong or Darjeeling. When not either going to the houses of lay supporters for ceremonial food offerings, or giving lectures, or attending the various functions held in honour of the sacred relics, some of us therefore took advantage of the opportunity of doing a little sightseeing, especially as there were a number of English-speaking young men who were willing to escort us wherever we wanted to go. One of the first things I saw was Bodhnath, the great stupa to the east of Kathmandu, that was said to contain relics of the former Buddha Kashyapa, the third of the five Buddhas of the present or auspicious aeon. About 100 feet in height, it consisted of a three-tiered circumambulary platform, a hemispherical dome, and a squared top piece surmounted by a 13-stepped pyramid, complete with ceremonial umbrella and sun-moon finial. Though the white dome and gilded upper portion of the stupa were themselves sufficiently impressive as they loomed against the blue sky that afternoon, they were not the most remarkable feature of the vast structure. Its most remarkable feature was the squared top piece, and the reason for this was that on each of the four gilded sides of the top piece there was painted an enormous pair of eyes. These eyes regarded one steadily. They even followed one as one circumambulated the stupa, and as one paused every now and then to peer into the shrines by which it was surrounded and which it completely dwarfed. Indeed, one had the feeling that they continued to follow one even after one had turned one's back on them, and in my case had entered the two-storied Tibetan-style building that was the abode of the Chinya Lama. I had not heard of the Chinya or Chinese Lama before, but the young men from the Nepal Bank who were escorting me that day were eager that I should meet him, and I gathered from their remarks that he was a well-known local character. The room in which he received us was not unlike the upstairs room at the Tapa Choling Gompa, in which the old Eagle Abbot and I, with Thubten Tenzing as interpreter, had carried on our discussions earlier in the year. That is to say, it was quite a small room and furnished in the traditional Tibetan manner, though from the richness of the furnishings it was evident that the Chinya Lama was a much wealthier man than the abbot of the Tapa Choling Gompa, and lived in a much grander style. It was also evident that he lived in a much less monastic style, for his abode swarmed with women and children and servants, and my interpreter on this occasion was a lively, attractive girl of 15 or 16, who introduced herself as the Chinya Lama's daughter. Since she had been educated at a convent school in India, she spoke excellent English, but being of an extremely talkative disposition, she kept breaking off in the middle of the sentence she was translating, in order to tell me at some length what an extremely holy man her father was, and how greatly he was respected by everybody. Meanwhile, the holy man himself sat there in his brocade robes, looking like a slightly depraved version of the original laughing Buddha. Since very little of what I said to him or he said to me actually got translated by his talkative and admiring daughter, there was no question of any meeting of minds. But to judge from his continual nods, smiles and winks, he was pleased to see me, though whether he was pleased to see me because he saw in me a potential disciple or a potential customer, it was difficult to tell. Whatever the truth of the matter may have been, we did not stay long with the Chinya Lama and were soon on our way down to the ancient town of Lalitpur, Patan, which was situated 2 or 3 miles south of Kathmandu. Lalita means natural, spontaneous, or charming, so that it would be possible to render Lalitpur as the city beautiful. It would even be possible to render it as the city of the fine arts, for the term Lalita also means fine, as distinct from applied, in the aesthetic sense. In either case, the rendering would be appropriate. As I saw when we entered the main square, the place was so beautiful as to be a veritable wonderland, and it owed its beauty not to nature, but almost entirely to art. On all sides rose palaces and temples and slender columns, on the top of which knelt royal personages with hands folded in prayer. A few of the buildings were of white stone, delicately chiselled, but most were of warm red brick and wood, and of these the majority were in the pagoda style of architecture, with tiered roofs and elaborately wrought doorways, trellis windows and roof struts, some of them painted and gilded. In the case of one enormous palace, the projecting eaves were supported by roof struts in the form of the fantastically elongated erect penises of gigantic monkey-like figures standing upright with their backs to the wall. Besides the palaces and the temples, though rising to a lesser height, there were the stupas, or chaityas, as the smaller ones were called, which I found not only in the main square, but in all the squares and courtyards through which we passed. In some of these, indeed, they were as thick on the ground as the monuments in an English churchyard. So many buildings and stupas were there, in fact, and so much art of every kind, that the thought of the length of time it must have taken to produce them all was inevitably suggestive of the beginningless prehistoric past into which recede and disappear the few score centuries of the world's recorded history. As I wrote in a rather lyrical article that I contributed to Stepping Stone soon after my return to Kalimpong, quote, If the larger monuments of Nepal convey such an impression by their sheer antiquity, the smaller ones convey it more indirectly but no less effectively by their staggering multiplicity and by their unbelievable richness of ornamentation. When one sees a geological formation miles high and composed of innumerable strata, and when one reflects that hundreds, perhaps thousands of years went into the making of a single inch-thick layer of rock, then one realizes how incalculably old the whole formation is, how ancient its mountains, how hoary with age its hills. And when one looks down through the clear blue waters which girdle some Pacific isle, sees the huge masses of delicately tinted pink and red coral branching up like great trees from the bottom, and considers how long it takes how many tiny creatures to add a single inch to their growth, then once again one's brain has to grapple with the thought of an almost infinite duration of millions of years of silent labour beneath the surface of the sea. Similar is the impression produced by the amazing multiplicity of the chatyas, viharas and temples of Nepal, by the thousands of tiny shrines which cluster at the corners of the streets, by the tens of thousands of carved wooden windows, doors and posts, by the millions of images, the miles of painted banners, the acres of hammered work in brass and copper, silver and gold. One feels that the production of such tremendous artistic wealth must have kept a whole nation busy for hundreds, if not for thousands of years. So enormous indeed is the number of objects which have been accumulated, and so unmistakably does each bear the stamp of the same fantastic beauty, that the spectator even feels like attributing their production to the inexhaustible fecundity of some great natural force rather than to the labour of mere human hands. This impression is heightened by the minuteness, delicacy and intricacy of much of the work. Leaving aside examples of craftsmanship in metal, ivory and wood, materials which easily lend themselves to fine workmanship, and taking instead an example such as the Mahabodhi Temple at Patan, one finds that every single square inch of its exterior surface has been carved with a tiny image of the Buddha, on a scale so minute that it at once reminded me of a passage in one of the sutras, which says that a Buddha, together with his company of bodhisattvas, is contained in every grain of dust, a symbolical way of expressing the truth that every phenomenon in the universe contains indestructibly the potentiality of Bodhi. End of quote. Quote is from Sangharakshita, Crossing the Stream, Windhorse, pages 120-121. These somewhat extravagantly worded comments had reference to Nepalese art and architecture in general, but there was no doubting the fact that one could experience what the same article called this feeling of incredible ancientness much more strongly amidst the glories of Lalitpur, which was a predominantly Buddhist town, than among the more hybrid splendours of either Kathmandu or Batgaon, the third of the three principal towns of the valley, which I visited about 10 days later. In the meantime, I continued to do what sightseeing I could in the intervals between my other activities. With Dhammaloka and two young Nepalese for company, I explored the curio shops in the Kathmandu Bazaar, saw the temple of White Tara, and paid a visit to the museum, where, not surprisingly, we found a number of remarkably beautiful images, painted scrolls and illuminated manuscripts. Dhammaloka and I also climbed the steps to the top of the Swayambhunath Hill in order to take a closer look at the great stupa that crowned its summit. Here we found ourselves in another world. On all sides there were chaityas and pagoda-style temples and other shrines, belfries and residential quarters, from the midst of which rose the enormous bulk of the Swayambhunath stupa. Apart from the fact that the circumambulatory platform had not been incorporated into the general structure, it was built in much the same style as Bodnath. There was, however, a difference in the relative proportions of the dome and the gilded upper portion of the stupa, the latter being at least twice the height of the former. Moreover, from the cornice of the squared top piece, which was surmounted not by a 13-stepped pyramid, but by 13 tapering rings, there rose 4 gilded triangular plates that gave the top piece the appearance of a head wearing a 4-pointed diadem. All this had the effect of giving the top piece much greater prominence, with the result that the enormous pair of eyes depicted on each of its gilded sides seemed to regard one even more steadily than at Bodnath, as well as more intently. As we made our way around the platform beneath their unblinking gaze, I noticed that strings of what, from a distance, looked like prayer flags were stretched from the umbrella of the stupa to the roofs of the surrounding temples and other buildings. On closer inspection, the prayer flags proved to be rectangular silver plates, each about 12 or 16 inches in size, hinged together lengthwise so as to give flexibility to the string to which they belonged. Each string must have consisted of 200 or 300 such plates. A similar inspection revealed that the openwork curtains hanging in front of some of the shrines, through which one had a glimpse of the image within, consisted of myriads of tiny metal rings fastened together in the manner of chain mail. Not that all the craftsmanship at Swayambhunath was on the same reduced scale. On a pedestal at the top of the stone-paved steps on the eastern side of the sacred hill lay a giant vajra or thunderbolt scepter, the tantric symbol of irresistible spiritual energy and insight. It was about 8 feet in length, and round it played a band of long-tailed grey monkeys, their quick, lithe movements contrasting in the most amusing fashion with the solidity and immovability of the vajra. On another occasion, I had the company not of Dhammaloka, but of someone I had known in Kalimpong. This was Ratnaman, the round-faced, rose-cheeked young Nuwa, who had taken over from Gan Jyoti as treasurer of the YMBA, but who was now living in Kathmandu with his half-brothers and helping in the family business. He had come to see me on the very day of my arrival, having heard that I was among the monks accompanying the sacred relics, and had offered his services as chikaran. With him and 4 or 5 other young men, therefore, I went to see the old palace, as it was called, a pagoda-style building that was now unoccupied, except, it was said, by the ghosts of those who had been murdered there. Unfortunately, it was not only unoccupied, but locked, and since the caretaker could not be found, we had to content ourselves with gazing up at the intricately carved lattice windows and roof struts, some of which were so badly cracked as to be in danger of disintegration. From this scene of desolation and decay, we drove to the Singha Durbar, stopping only to ascend a tower which, so my companions assured me, was 200 years old and 200 feet high. Whether it was really as high as that, it was difficult to tell, but it was high enough, and from the top we had a fine view of the whole of Kathmandu, with Bodnath to the east, Swayambhunath on its hill to the west, and the Himalayas far away to the north. The Singha Durbar was built in the same neoclassical style as the Narayan Hiti, but on a much larger scale. I indeed have the impression, which may have been mistaken, that it was 2 or 3 times as big. If this was the case, it was not surprising, for since the upper floors of the Singha Durbar comprised the official residence of the hereditary Rana Prime Ministers, and the lower ones the Secretariat, it had been, until very recently, the real seat of power in Nepal. But if it is true that uneasy lies the head that wears a crown, that head lies all the more uneasy if the crown, or the power that the crown represents, has been usurped. On our approaching the Singha Durba, I noticed that there were no flights of steps as at the Narayan Hiti. Neither were there any flights of steps within the building. In order to reach the upper floors where the Prime Minister lived, we had to climb up a narrow, winding iron staircase, at the top of which was an iron trapdoor. Access to the person of the Prime Minister had obviously been made as difficult as possible, no doubt as a precaution against assassination by an opponent of autocracy or a coup d'etat by a brother or nephew impatient for power. On emerging from the trapdoor, which had been opened especially for us, we found ourselves in a series of state apartments, which, like those of the Narayan Hiti, were furnished in European style, but far more splendidly and luxuriously. The finest of these apartments was the vast reception hall with its dozens of crystal chandeliers, from the broad balcony of which one looked out onto the courtyard. To this courtyard, in the days before the Democratic Revolution, would come or be brought all those who had any business with the Prime Minister, and at 10 o'clock each morning he would appear on the balcony and deal with them. One of the young men told me that if the Prime Minister happened to be in a good mood, a criminal who had been brought for sentence might be given a government job, whereas if he happened to be in a bad mood, an innocent citizen who had come with a petition for a government job might be sent to jail. Such were the ways of autocracy. Having climbed down the spiral staircase and heard the trap door being closed and bolted above our heads, we drove from the Singha Durba to another neoclassical Rana Palace. This was the residence of the Commander-in-Chief, Keshab Shamsa Janga Bahadur Rana. Though not nearly so big as the Singha Durba, it was furnished in very much better taste and contained an excellent library, consisting, for the most part, of finely bound volumes of the English classics. I was therefore not surprised to learn that Keshab Shamsa was reputed to be the most cultured of the Ranas, that he was a liberal patron of the arts, particularly of Nepali literature, and that besides being Commander-in-Chief, he was, or had been, the young men differed about this, a popular Minister of Education. Behind the palace there was a garden, or rather a series of gardens, one for each of the 6 seasons of the Indian year, and here too Keshab Shamsa's good taste was very much in evidence. Since it was winter, it was the winter garden that was in bloom, principally with bronze, white, yellow and pink chrysanthemums. The garden that appealed to me most, however, was the spring garden, though it appealed to me not on account of its flowers, which were not yet out, but on account of the verses that had been inscribed on a marble slab high up on the wall, verses with which I had been familiar since my boyhood, and which now gave me, as they had given me 100 times before, a keen thrill of delight. Alas, that spring should vanish with the rose, that youth's sweet-scented manuscript should close. The nightingale that in the branches sang, ah, whence and whither flown again, who knows? Ah, love, could thou and I with fate conspire to grasp this sorry scheme of things entire, would we not shatter it to bits, and then remould it nearer to the heart's desire? Ah, moon of my delight, who knowest no wane, the moon of heaven is rising once again. How oft hereafter rising shall she look through this same garden after me in vain? It was strange to find Omar Khayyam's verses inscribed, with such exquisite appropriateness, in the garden of a neoclassical Rana palace in Kathmandu. There was little doubt that Keshab Shamsa's reputation as the most cultured member of his clan was well deserved. Cultured or not cultured, however, a Rana was a Rana, and autocracy was autocracy. And the Buddhist Niwas, at least, were glad to think that the moon that rose over the shrines and palaces of the Kathmandu Valley would in future look in vain not only for Keshab Shamsa, but for the whole tribe of Ranas. They were glad to think that even if the democratic revolution had not actually shattered the existing scheme of things to bits, it had in certain important respects remoulded it a little nearer to their heart's desire. For were not the sacred relics now being exposed for worship at the Ananda Kuti Vihara each day, and were not their own Niwari-speaking monks looking after the precious contents of the silver gilt reliquary and explaining their significance? Things that would have been impossible under the Rana regime. While I was busy sightseeing in the company of Dhammaloka and my young Nepalese friends, as well as meeting people and giving lectures, the white-clad Niwas therefore continued to pour into the Vihara in their hundreds to worship these sacred relics, with a fervour which, by all accounts, was hardly second to that of the Tibetans, whom I had seen paying their respects to the remains of the two Arahants in Gangtok and Kalimpong a few months earlier. After a week, the flood of white-clad devotees having abated slightly, the sacred relics were taken first to Lalitpur and then to Badgeon, the Buddhist inhabitants of which were eager to have the opportunity of welcoming them to their own cities, which in ancient times had been the capitals of independent kingdoms. This meant that the visiting monks were again needed to help look after the sacred relics, especially when they were being taken in procession from the Ananda Kuti Vihara to the Gaya Bahal Vihara in Lalitpur and from the Gaya Bahal Vihara to the old palace in Badgeon, as well as needed to take part in the large and enthusiastic public meetings that were held in both places. In Lalitpur, where the sacred relics were exposed for worship for 4 days, the public meeting was held under the presidency of Crown Prince Mahendra, while in predominantly Hindu Badgeon, where they remained for only a day and a night, it was held under the presidency of MP Korala, the new Prime Minister, who had replaced Mohan Shamsa a few days earlier. At each of these meetings, the first of which lasted for several hours, I spoke briefly in English. The rest of the time I spent simply studying the scene, particularly the faces of the other speakers, most of whom spoke either in Niwari or in Nepali, neither of which I understood. One of the faces I studied most at the Lalitpur meeting was that of Crown Prince Mahendra, who sat listening to the various speakers without the slightest show of interest. Lok Darshan, the king's private secretary, and other friends had hinted to me that the Crown Prince was quite stupid, perhaps even mentally deficient, and that he possessed no political influence whatever. He certainly lacked his royal father's openness of manner, and it was difficult to tell what he was thinking, if indeed he was thinking anything at all, especially as his eyes were concealed behind a pair of dark glasses. Years later, when he had succeeded to the throne, and when the name of King Mahendra of Nepal had become a byword for political astuteness throughout Asia, I wondered whether his former so-called stupidity had not been deliberately assumed. Lok Darshan, whom the new king eventually shut up in prison for a number of years, may well have wondered the same thing. Whatever the truth of the matter may have been, the Crown Prince's presence at the meeting that afternoon hardly added to the liveliness of the proceedings, and I was not sorry when the long series of speeches came to an end. As soon as I decently could, I left for Kathmandu, where I had to deliver a lecture, from thence returning to Lalitpur with Dr. Soft and Devapriya Valasinha, in time to attend a kind of religious service at the Gaya Bahal Vihara. Apart from the singing of the bands of worshippers who made their way up to the Swayambhunath Stupa every morning before dawn, and my brief and inadequate exchanges with the four young hermits of Shantiniketan. This was my first real contact with traditional Nepalese Buddhism, as distinct from the so-called reformist Theravada, which Amritananda and his colleagues were seeking to introduce in its place, and the experience moved me deeply. Unlike the Ananda Kuti Vihara, the Gaya Bahal Vihara was not a modern structure, but one of the oldest and most important, as well as most richly carved and decorated religious foundations in Lalitpur, and indeed in the whole Kathmandu Valley. Originally, it had been a vihara in the stricter sense of the term, that is, it had been not only a temple, but a monastery, and had housed, besides images of the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, a community of celibate monks. Centuries ago, however, under the influence of a misunderstood and misapplied Vajrayana, or Tantric Buddhism, these monks had not only given up their vows and married, but had continued to live in the Vihara with their wives and families, and to conduct religious ceremonies there. The monks had thus, in effect, become priests, and occupied, among the Newar Buddhists, a position analogous to that of the Brahmins among the Hindus. Indeed, like the Brahmins, they had become not just priests, but hereditary priests, for the present-day incumbents of the Vihara claimed to be the direct descendants of the ex-monks of medieval times. A similar development had, it seemed, taken place at all the other Viharas in the Kathmandu Valley, with the result that in the course of a few generations, the character of Nepalese Buddhism had entirely changed. What kind of spiritual life was being pursued in the secularized, or at least laicized, cloisters of the other Viharas, I had no means of telling. But the scene I witnessed at the Gaya Bahal Vihara that evening was sufficient to convince me that, degenerate though it undoubtedly was in certain respects, traditional Nepalese Buddhism was by no means dead. As I wrote shortly afterwards in the same lyrical article from which I have already quoted, quote, "Aloft on the altar, the end of the chamber, stood a silver image of the thousand-armed Avalokiteshvara. Innumerable lamps were burning and shed a soft lustre on the dark crimson pillars and yellow frescoed walls. A long row of yellow-robed figures, one of men, the other of women, sat on the right and left side, respectively, of the nave of the shrine. They chanted with half-closed eyes, their hands assuming various mudras, and the sound of their chanting was sweet as the music of birds in the trees of Sukhavati. At a signal from their leader, a stout, dignified old man who sat on a throne nearest the altar, holding the vajra in his right hand and the bell in his left, the deep-throated Tibetan trumpet would roar and the drums beat until the whole place trembled and shook with spiritual vibrations. Then again the brisk, sweet chant would rise up like a wave, and the row of shaven-headed old women sitting opposite me would sway themselves gently to and fro, eyes closed, their wrinkled faces shining in the soft, golden light of the lamps, absorbed within themselves and oblivious to the sights and sounds of the outer world." Unquote. So deeply did that service at the Gaya Bahal Vihara move me that, as I stole from the shrine and crept down the uneven stairs into the darkened streets and heard the sound of the chanting dying away behind me in the distance, I could not help thinking that it was in an atmosphere and environment such as this, profoundly peaceful, yet full of hidden life and secret activity, rather than amidst the noise and bustle of the Ananda Kuti Vihara, that there might be engendered a spiritual impulse dynamic enough to bring about a revival of Buddhism in Nepal. The public meeting that took place in Bad Gaon 4 days later marked the easternmost point of the sacred relics' peregrinations, as well as the virtual end of their visit to Nepal. Except that it was the new Prime Minister who presided and not the Crown Prince, the meeting follows much the same pattern as the one held in Lalitpur. And once again I studied the faces of the other speakers. On the way from Lalitpur to Bad Gaon, it had, however, been my good fortune to see the Kumari, or Virgin, as she was known, the young Newar Buddhist girl who was believed to be the incarnation of the bloodthirsty Hindu goddess of Taliju, the tutelary deity of the royal house. One of the strangest examples of the way in which the Buddhism of Nepal had become contaminated with Hinduism. On my arrival in Lalitpur that morning with some of the younger Newar monks, the jeep in which we were travelling had been irresistibly drawn into the procession that had already begun escorting the sacred relics to Bad Gaon. As the mass of white-clad humanity, by which we were soon surrounded, slowly made its way through the narrow, winding streets of the ancient city, I had plenty of time to look about me. On either side rose tier upon tier of elaborately carved windows, all slanting slightly outwards, and looking down at the procession from one of the finest of these, I saw the inscrutable face of a young girl dressed as a Hindu goddess. Her almond-shaped eyes were enlarged with kohl, and there was a third eye painted in the centre of her forehead. "The Kumari," whispered my young companions, momentarily awestruck despite their Theravada training. In Bad Gaon, I had the opportunity of seeing the old palace, where the sacred relics were exposed for worship, and where the monks were given a ceremonial meal before the meeting, as well as the no less famous Nayatpala, or five-roofed temple. The former residence of the Malla kings was an imposing but rather dilapidated building, in which the warm red of the external brickwork made a pleasing contrast with the brown of the richly carved wooden string courses, doors, windows and roof struts, from which most of the paint and gilding had long since peeled away. As for the temple, it was dedicated to the bloodthirsty Hindu goddess Bhavani and was a perfect example of the Nepalese pagoda style of architecture. Rectangular in shape and consisting of five stories of decreasing size, each with its own roof, it stood on the fifth and last of a series of rectangular stone terraces, also of decreasing size, which clearly were intended to duplicate the five roofs towering above. On account of this arrangement, the structure gave an impression of both solidity and lightness. It was as though it was difficult to disturb, but that it might, at the same time, fly away at any moment. Nor was this all. Running up the front of the terraces was a flight of stone steps, and on either side of the steps, on the edge of each of the terraces, sat or stood a pair of divine, or human or animal figures, no doubt the guardians of the approach to the Holy of Holies. These figures were all of enormous size and brilliantly painted, and introduced into the front of the temple, at least, an element of life and animation that would otherwise have been lacking. On taking a closer look at them after the meeting, before leaving for Kathmandu with Alanji and some friends from Trichandra College, I also saw that the figures were extremely well executed. Flanking the steps at ground level were two seated sages or divinities. They could have been either. Behind and above them, two standing elephants, magnificently caparisoned. Behind and above the elephants, two lions, and so on, all gazing straight ahead and all seemingly oblivious to the swarms of men, women, and children who were constantly ascending and descending the steps between them. So fascinating was the busy, colourful scene that, had I been on my own, I would probably have remained in the temple square for an hour or two more, simply observing. But the friends from Chichanja College had arranged for Anandji and me to give lectures that afternoon, and we had to be on our way. The lectures were held at the Saraswati Sadan, a hall which, as its name suggested, was dedicated to the Hindu and Mahayana Buddhist goddess of learning and culture. Both Anandji and I had already spoken there several times. We were, in fact, the two most popular speakers among the visiting monks, especially with the students, who invariably gave us an enthusiastic reception. On the present occasion, I spoke on Buddhism and education, and was followed by Anandji on Buddhism and dialectical materialism, a subject that, as I knew, was very close to his heart. After we had given our lectures, we answered questions, of which there were, as usual, quite a number. At first, these were addressed now to me and now to Anandji, more or less alternately. But after some 15 or 20 minutes, they began to be directed exclusively to Anandji. Moreover, they all came out of the darkness at the very back of the hall. They all came seemingly from one and the same person, though who it was I was unable to descry. And they all revolved round the same topic. This topic was the Atman, the unchanging immortal self, which, according to Hinduism, constitutes the inmost essence of man and is the subject of transmigration. The reason for the questions was that in the course of his lecture, Anandji had touched on the Buddhist Anatma doctrine, that is to say, that there is no unchanging immortal self, that the phenomena of consciousness arise in dependence on conditions, ceasing when those conditions cease, and that the process of transmigration does not logically require an unchanging transmigrant. As the questions came out of the darkness, each one more insidious than the last, I realised that the unseen questioner could hardly be a student. Anandji was being seriously challenged on his own ground. The Anatma doctrine was being attacked. Buddhism itself was being attacked, and being attacked in a manner that was all the more deadly for being so subtle. I also realised that Anandji, who was not at his best when dealing with topics of a purely philosophical nature, was simply parrying the questions rather than answering them, and even, in some cases, trying to turn them aside with one of the witticisms for which he was so justly famous. Eventually, the exchange came to an inconclusive end. The meeting broke up. And as Anandji and I stepped down from the platform, the crowd parted respectfully to make way for a wizened little old man in traditional Nepalese dress, who, emerging from between their ranks, slowly and deliberately limped towards us, his steps supported by a silver-headed cane. Friends hastened to introduce the newcomer, who clearly was none other than Anandji's unseen questioner on the topic of the Atman. In a deferential undertone, we were informed that he was His Holiness Hemaraj, the Rajpurohit, or royal chaplain, a personage who, as I already knew, was a pillar of Hindu socio-religious orthodoxy, and moreover, one who, until the collapse of the Rana autocracy, had been the second most powerful man in the country. Gravely, and with an air of punctilious politeness, he shook hands all round. When it came to my turn, I perceived that his hand was not only withered with age, but also cold and dry as that of a corpse. Nor was this all that I perceived. The truth of the matter was that I had met the Rajpurohit before, though not in the flesh, and that on his emergence from the crowd, I had recognised him instantly, even as he, no doubt, had recognised me. He was not just a high-caste Brahmin, not just the royal chaplain. In reality, he was a much more dark and dangerous figure, and in view of the nature of our previous encounter, I did not find it at all surprising that on the present occasion he should have attacked the Anatma doctrine, and in this way have sought to undermine the foundations of the higher spiritual life. The encounter in question had taken place in Delhi 7 years earlier, only a few weeks after my arrival in India. I was meditating one night when there suddenly appeared before me, as it were suspended in mid-air, the head of an old man. He had a grey stubble on his scalp and chin, and his yellowish face was deeply lined and wrinkled, as though with the sins of a lifetime. "You're wasting your time," he exclaimed with a dreadful sneer. "There's nothing in the universe but matter. Nothing but matter." "There is something higher than matter," I promptly retorted. "I know it, because I am experiencing it now," whereupon the apparition vanished. Why I should have encountered the old man a second time I do not know, but there was absolutely no doubt in my mind that the head that I now saw beneath a black Nepalese cap and attached to a correspondingly wizened body at the Sarasvati Sadan in Kathmandu was the very same head that I had seen suspended in mid-air before me in Delhi all those years ago. There was the same grey stubble, the same yellowish complexion, the same lines and wrinkles. Even the slightly high-pitched, sneering tone of voice was the same, so that the insidious questions that the Rajpurohit had put to Anandji about the Atman seemed to be identical in spirit and intent with the declaration of the Mara, or Evil One, as I believed him to be, that there was nothing in the universe but matter. But though I recognised the old man, and though he must have recognised me, neither of us gave any sign of having done so, and after we had exchanged a few commonplace remarks, he politely took leave of us all. Reflecting on the episode afterwards, I felt more convinced than ever that, if it was in fact Mara's head that had appeared to me in Delhi, and if that head was identical with the head I had seen beneath the black Nepalese cap, then in some mischievous way Mara and the Rajpurohit were a single entity, or at least were intimately connected. Nor was this surprising. The Rajpurohit was a pillar of orthodox Hinduism, and in Nepal the practice of orthodox Hinduism involved the rigid, and until recently the legally enforced, observance of the caste system, including untouchability, together with the ritual slaughter of countless buffaloes, goats and chickens, to bloodthirsty male and female divinities, abominations which it was possible to support only if it was one's business to represent irreligion as religion, and in this way to encourage people to follow the path that led downwards into darkness rather than the path that led upwards into light. Besides lecturing at the Sarasvati Sadan and other places, Anandji and I also took part in the various meetings that were held in connection with the affairs of the Dharmodaya Sabha. From a purely monastic point of view, the most important of these was a formal assembly of all the Nepalese and non-Nepalese monks, at which two Niwari Shamaniras, or novices, were received into the Theravada monastic order as bhikshus, or full monks. Narada Thera presided at this ceremony, which was held at the Anandakuti Vihara within a simha, or ecclesiastical boundary, that had been established some years earlier. Before they could perform the ordination ceremony, the monks had to purify themselves by, quote, confessing their sins, unquote, in the technical sense of confessing any breach of the Vinaya, or monastic code, of which they had been guilty since last taking part in an assembly of that nature. In the earliest days of Buddhism, the confession of sins had taken place at the fortnightly chapter meeting, but this practice had soon fallen into abeyance, and among Theravadin monks, at least, confession was now not only less public, but also, as I discovered, much more of a formality. At a signal from Narada Thera, we all split up into pairs, squatting on our heels and facing each other. I was paired with Venerable Amritananda. Since I had not had an opportunity of, quote, confessing my sins, unquote, since my bhikshu ordination the previous year, I naturally thought that it was incumbent on me to make a mental review of my conduct over the previous 12 months, in order to ascertain whether I did in fact have something to confess. But Venerable Amritananda gave me no time. Hardly had we taken up our positions than he let fly at me a string of Pali formulae, rattling them off with such rapidity that I could make out only part of the meaning. He then made me repeat the same formulae after him, for I did not know them by heart as he did, with variations appropriate to our different status within the monastic order. The whole business took no more than 3 or 4 minutes. All around us, pairs of monks were already rising to their feet. We had, quote, confessed our sins, unquote, and purified ourselves, and could now proceed to confer the higher ordination on the 2 Shramaneras. This was by no means the only time that I was made painfully aware of the extreme formalism of the modern Theravada. Narada Thera had visited Kathmandu 5 or 6 years earlier, and on that occasion the Newar Buddhists had presented him with a considerable sum of money, which he had, it appeared, deposited with Manihas Jyoti. Calling Manihas Ji over to him one day, when the latter happened to be paying a brief visit to the islander Kuti Vihara, Narada Thera reminded the worthy trader how much money he had deposited with him, how much of it had since been dispersed in accordance with his, Narada's, instructions, and how much remained. Having done this, he not only directed Manihas Ji to disperse various sums on his behalf for this and that purpose, but also told him how much there would be on deposit after these instructions had been carried out. Either because he was very much a man of the world or because he was accustomed to the ways of Theravada monks, Manihas Ji attended to Narada Thera's behests without giving the slightest sign that there was anything unusual about them, and having assured him that everything would be done according to his wishes, quietly left the vihara. For my part, I was astonished at what I had heard. It was not that I was astonished by the power of Narada Thera's memory, for the amounts he had mentioned were not just round figures, but exact to the last rupee and anna, or by his extraordinary capacity for mental arithmetic and even mental bookkeeping. What astonished me was the fact that it was possible for the doyen of the English-speaking monks of Ceylon to receive and spend money through a lay intermediary, and yet at the same time firmly believe himself to be a strict observer of the rule that a monk should not handle money, literally gold and silver. Evidently for Narada Thera, as for so many other Theravadins, observance of the Vinaya meant observance of the letter of the Vinaya, and only of the letter. There was absolutely no question of observing the spirit, or even of thinking in such terms. On another occasion, it was borne in on me that Theravada formalism could sometimes coincide with Sinhalese cultural chauvinism, and for this insight too I was indebted to Narada Thera. A group of white-clad Newar Buddhists had come to pay him their respects, which they did in what was for them the traditional manner, by first standing with joined palms, then kneeling, and then touching the ground with their foreheads, the whole procedure being repeated thrice. Though pleased with their devotion, Narada-Tera could not resist the opportunity of striking a blow for, quote, the pure Dhamma, and therefore lost no time in taking them to task for prostrating themselves, quote, in the wrong way, unquote. Turning to me, he exclaimed in his high-pitched voice, and with a bland unconsciousness that there could be any other way of doing things than his own, tell them to prostrate themselves in the correct way, in the Salon way. What I actually did tell them in Hindi, which my elder brother in the Dhamma did not understand, I no longer recollect, but it was certainly not what I had been told to tell them, and the Niwas therefore withdrew from Narada-Tera's presence, unconscious of the faux pas they had committed, and without having learnt to prostrate themselves in the correct way. A few days later, Narada-Tera was the central figure in an episode which took place in surroundings very different from those of the Ananda Kirti Vihara, and which, while not illustrating Theravada formalism, sheds an interesting light on the methods by which Theravada monks sought to ingratiate themselves with the laity, especially when the latter happened to be rich and powerful. The scene of the episode was the Narayanhiti, the abode of Narayan, or royal palace. At Venerable Amritananda's suggestion, the king had invited all the monks for a ceremonial food offering, and upwards of 40 yellow and orange-robed figures had gathered in the spacious apartment that had been selected for the purpose. Food was served in the Indian style on thalis, or circular trays. These trays were all of enormous size and all of massy silver, and there was an abundance of basins and ewers to match. After the meal, Narada-Tera, as the senior-most monk present, delivered the customary sermon of thanksgiving, as it may be called. For some reason or other, he not only insisted on addressing the king in Sinhalese, he also insisted that Anandji, who had spent several years in Ceylon, should translate his remarks into Hindi, even though his royal auditor both understood and spoke English perfectly. When I returned to Shantiniketan that evening, Anandji exploded. He had never been so embarrassed in all his life, he declared. As delivered in Sinhalese, Narada-Tera's sermon had consisted of nothing but the grossest flattery of the king, whom he had unblushingly extolled as the modern Ashoka, as the embodiment of all the virtues, and so on. It made him positively sick even to think of all the things he had had to translate. In fact, he had not really translated them. He had been unable to. He had paraphrased them and toned down the flattery as much as he could. Even so, the result was bad enough, and while speaking, he had hardly been able to look the king in the face. Anandji's explosion was, however, more of a mock explosion than a real one, for his sense of humour never deserted him for long, and he was able to see the comic side of the episode. Soon we were laughing over what had happened, and Anandji was regaling me with some of the choicer specimens of Narada-Tera's rhetoric, which, since he had not translated them at the time, I had been unable to appreciate. But though we laughed, we both in fact felt more than a little sad, and more than a little ashamed, for we were conscious that Narada-Tera's performance, which he himself appeared to think entirely appropriate to the occasion, did not reflect much credit on the monastic order, in fact showed it in rather an unattractive light. We were also conscious that it raised some serious questions. Even granting that it was necessary not to give offence to the rich and powerful, and even to gain their sympathy and support, was it really desirable to flatter them so grossly as to overstep the bounds of truth and decency? Was it, in fact, desirable to flatter them at all? And if it was, how far could a Buddhist monk, or indeed any self-respecting person, permit himself to go in this direction? Moreover, where did honest praise end and flattery begin? And how was one to distinguish the one from the other? According to Ullenjee, flattery was a regular feature of the Thanksgiving Sermon of Ceylon, and in addressing King Tribhuvan in the way he had done, Narada Thera was only following a well-established tradition. Why, in Ceylon, every petty village benefactor was eulogized as a modern Anatta Pindika or a modern Visakha, and praises that had once been the reward of the giver of millions were now lavished on the donor of a few rupees. The reason for this state of affairs, Ullenjee went on to explain, was largely economic. Theravada monks were like the lilies of the field. They toiled not, neither did they spin. Consequently, they were dependent for their support on the laity. And since they were dependent on the laity, they had to be careful to keep on good terms with them. What easier way of keeping on good terms with them could there be than by flattering them a little from time to time, and in particular, flattering them on account of their generosity, especially their generosity to the members of the monastic order? In staunchly Theravadin Ceylon, so Ullenjee assured me, the monastic order was the basis of Buddhism. Since the monastic order was dependent for its support on the generosity of the laity, and since that generosity was not usually forthcoming without the help of a good deal of flattery, this meant that in Ceylon, flattery was the basis of Buddhism. Perhaps Narada Thera had flattered the king because he wanted to make sure of his continued support for Theravada Buddhism and the Theravada monastic order. Whether or not it was true that in Ceylon flattery was the basis of Buddhism, and I already knew Ullenjee to be capable of both cynicism and comic exaggeration, it was certainly true that without the support of King Tribhuvan and the government of Nepal, it would have been impossible for the sacred relics to visit Nepal or to be given such a lavish reception. It was also true that now that the sacred relics had been exposed for worship in Kathmandu, Lalitpur and Bad Gion, their sojourn in the land of the Buddha's birth was beginning to come to an end. I had intended to pass my last 2 days immersed in the peaceful atmosphere of Shantiniketan, but on the first of these days, Venerable Amritananda succeeded in convincing me that before leaving the country, I ought to see a little of Nepalese rural life. And I therefore accompanied him first to Bad Gion, and then to a pleasant valley entirely surrounded by beautiful green hills. Here we walked through the well-tended fields and market gardens, and I admired the methods of the sturdy Newar cultivators, who, Amritananda informed me, belonged to the Jayapu caste, which was the lowest caste among the Newars. On the following day, my last full day in Nepal, I was able to immerse myself in the peaceful atmosphere of Shantiniketan for at least part of the time. Having hunted for Nepalese handmade paper with Ratzaman and participated in a ceremonial food offering at the Srigar Vihara, I returned to the Swayambhunath Hill and the Abode of Peace, and spent the afternoon talking to the four young hermits, who by this time I'd got to know quite well. In the evening, their father, Yogaratna, came to see me and told me the story of his life and spiritual experiences, a brief account of which I included in the rather lyrical article that I contributed to Stepping Stones soon after my return to Kalimpong, and from which I have already quoted more than once. Quote, "It transpired that his wife had died many years before," I wrote after describing his appearance and his manner of speaking, "and that not long afterwards he had resigned a lucrative government appointment in order to devote himself exclusively to the study of religion and the practice of yoga, sometimes living in temples, sometimes roaming about naked, and sometimes retiring into remote jungles and dwelling in inaccessible caves, where, I heard later from one who had spent a few days with him in such a place, supernatural beings of frightful appearance visited him in such numbers that no other person dared to remain there with him. Step by step he had advanced upon the hard and dangerous path of spiritual training, gradually acquiring in the course of his practice not only calm and illumination of mind, but also various supernormal powers, which, he told me one evening, had arisen spontaneously and become, as I could see for myself from the number of people who came to him for advice and instruction each day, the means of attracting numerous disciples and devotees. End of quote. The next morning, after the singing of the bands of pre-dawn worshippers had awoken me for the last time, I said goodbye to Yogaratna and his sons and made my way to the Srigarh Vihara. Here, the other members of the delegation accompanying the sacred relics had already started assembling, and it was not long before the final details of the last procession in which we would be taking part on Nepalese soil had been sorted out between ourselves and Venerable Amritananda. But before the procession could actually start, the monks had to be fed, and at 11 o'clock my yellow-robed brethren and I therefore sat down to our last ceremonial meal at the hands of our warm-hearted Niwari hosts. One of us no doubt delivered a sermon of thanksgiving, but it must have been a short one, for at 12:30 the procession left the Srigarh Vihara and started winding its way towards the aerodrome. Once again the enthusiasm was immense. Once again the streets were lined with thousands of white-clad Niwars and hundreds of khaki-clad Gurkha policemen. Once again there was a great crowd waiting at the aerodrome, including King Tribhuvan and the members of his government. This time, however, the crowd was waiting not to welcome the sacred relics, but to bid them farewell. And although the atmosphere was one of rejoicing, for the time that the sacred relics had spent in Nepal constituted an epoch in the history of modern Nepalese Buddhism, the rejoicing was therefore not untinged with sadness. The vast majority of those present knew that they would not have another opportunity of paying their respects to the relics of the two Arahants. And as the silver gilt reliquary was carried across the tarmac and up into the waiting aeroplane, many of them wiped tears from their eyes. Nonetheless, the last sound I heard before the cabin door closed behind us was that of the repeated triumphant shouts of "Sadhu!" that rose spontaneously from the throats of the crowd. While the last sight that met my eyes as I looked out of the cabin window was that of a sea of upturned faces and frantically waving arms. A few minutes later, shortly after midday, the aeroplane took off, and after a journey of little more than 3 hours, including a brief stopover at Patna, we landed at Dum Dum Airport, and soon were again breathing the smoke-filled atmosphere of Calcutta. The last but one of the sacred relics journeys outside India was over, and sitting that evening in my dingy room at the Mahabodhi Society's headquarters, I felt the sharpness of the contrasts that I had encountered during the past 2 weeks already beginning to fade. End of chapter 14.